Okay, so here we are again. We can continue on our discussion, in particular, on how to overcome defilements of the mind. This is, as I've been saying, one of the most important things on the path to be able to deepen your meditation practice. And we have been looking at, so far, at ill will, and now I want to have a look at karma, sensual desire, sensual objects, that kind of thing, which is probably the biggest obstacle to get the mind deep into deep meditation. So this is obviously very important. And the purpose of this particular sutta is just to give a number of similes about how to regard karma, the sensual desire. And these similes kind of give you a big picture about these things. And so they're kind of useful for reflection. They're not kind of standards to be taken. This is how you have to look at the world from now on or anything like that. They're more kind of reflections that you can do. And as you reflect on these things in this way, it's like you're potentially, at least, your mind will shift a little bit and start to look at the world in a new way. And you will start to look for the happinesses and the pleasure in the world in a slightly different place from what you used to before. And that's kind of the purpose of this. To move the mind to a higher type of pleasure, higher type of happiness, which is more reliable, which is more internal, which is not dependent on the external world so much. So please take them in that way as kind of things to reflect on, and then they can become quite useful. This word karma in Pali, which is often translated as sensual pleasure in these texts, it has a kind of double meaning. On the one side, it means the desires that we have for the objects of the senses. That's the one thing. So the desires themselves, it refers to the actual desire. On the other hand, it refers to the actual objects of the senses. Right? And that is actually the more important meaning, is actually the objects themselves. But the two go together, go hand in hand. You can't really have the desire without the objects. You can't have the objects without the desire. So they're kind of bound up with each other. Okay, so let's have a look at the similes. I usually read out the similes every retreat because I really like them myself. I find them very kind of useful useful reflections. So that's why I always bring them up. This is from the Potalya Sutta. And this is a sutta spoken to a man called Potalya. So he was a layman, which is good, which means that it is kind of... It's a suitable thing both for monastics and for lay people. It's not just a kind of one-sided thing, anything like that. So this is what it says to this householder. Householder, suppose a dog overcome by hunger and weakness was waiting by a butcher's shop. Then a skilled butcher or his apprentice would toss the dog a well-hacked, clean-hacked skeleton of meatless bones smeared with blood. What do you think, householder? Would that dog get rid of his hunger and weakness by gnawing such a well-hacked, clean-hacked skeleton or meatless bones smeared with blood? No, venerable sir. Why is that? Because that was a skeleton of well-hacked, clean-hacked, meatless bones smeared with blood. Eventually that dog would reap weariness and disappointment. So too, householder, a noble disciple considers thus. Sensual pleasures have been compared to a skeleton by the Blessed One. They provide much suffering and much despair, while the danger in them is great. So that is the first simile, the simile of the dog which is waiting by the butcher shop. And so the idea here is that this dog comes around. It's hungry, right? Just like beings have craving for sensual pleasures. Craving for sensual pleasures is like a hunger, or it's like a thirst, right? A thirst inside. If the craving is very strong, you have to have a drink, right? Very thirsty. Craving is like that. It's like a sense of desperation, this urge. You've got to have it. And so this dog has that hunger, and sensual pleasures can sometimes be like that. This very powerful urge to get your fill of whatever kind of pleasure it is. In fact, the word tanha, which is the word for craving, often translated as craving, it really means something like thirst. That's really the original meaning of that word. So it refers not to just any kind of desire, but it refers to those very strong, powerful desires that are very, like thirst or hunger or whatever. Yeah. So here is this dog, right? Hungry and weak and kind of waiting to get some real sustenance. You want some real sustenance when you're hungry and weak. Yeah. So waiting outside the butcher shop. The butcher shop is like the world, right? The world promising you all of these sensual pleasures. Everything looks so nice through the window. Wow, it's so beautiful in there. And then, even though everything looks so nice through the window, out of that door comes a clean hack to meatless bones smeared with blood. There is no meat there. There's no sustenance there. All there is a little bit of taste. And that dog gets the taste. And of course, soon enough, that's all it gets. So soon enough, it must run off to the next butcher shop, hanging outside the window again, seeing all the nice things in there. Everything looks so delicious and beautiful and wonderful when you look at it beforehand. And then when it gets tossed out again, all you get is this well-hacked, clean-hacked skeleton of meatless bones. You get the taste of the blood, right? You get a little bit of taste of what's going on. No real satisfaction, no real nourishment. And you run off to the next butcher shop, and on it goes, right? On and on and on. And there is no end to that, and there is never any real satisfaction to be had in that way. And this is the simile for craving, the simile for sensual pleasures. You run after them, you run and run after them, and eventually you get it, right? You get a bit of a taste. It's kind of, you get that new car or whatever it is, and it tastes nice for a while, and soon enough it is not really all that exciting anymore. You'd think about this car for years beforehand, and then when you finally get it, it has a few days of kind of satisfaction, and you start, soon enough, you're looking for the next car or whatever it is. So this is an endless kind of running around, running. You keep on going. There is no end to that running, right? That dog will never be satisfied, and because it's never satisfied, it will always have to look for the next butcher's shop. There is no end to craving. Craving is a self-perpetuating force that keeps you running forever. And that's kind of scary, right? That this thing potentially just goes on forever. No end in sight. But you are still not really get it, right? This is the problem. You don't get it because you don't see any escape from that. You don't see any alternatives. So you keep on running and running and running. And nothing, you don't really get anywhere. And then one day you discover there is something called meditation practice. And you sit down and you start watching the breath, and the craving starts to die down a little bit. You experience some contentment, some peace. And you realize, actually, there is another way of dealing with this. You don't have to run after the craving all the time. You can find a different kind of pleasure. That pleasure, you start to build it up by living a good life. And then when you sit down in meditation, it starts to bite. And if you get into a deep state of meditation, you realize, for the first time in your life, you have found something where there is no craving. There's complete satisfaction. You have found that goal that the craving was promising you all along but never could deliver. You found it somewhere else by moving away from the craving, finding that inner happiness instead. And then one day, wow, this is it. No craving anymore. No desire. I feel complete. I feel fulfilled. I feel that itch inside, which always needed to be itched, always needed to be looked after, is now gone. And I feel complete as a being for the first time. And this, in a sense, is what samadhi, the experience of samadhi, is a bit like that. A sense of completion, of fulfillment, as if you find the meaning of life itself. You've been running around trying to find this meaning of life. It was never there. And then one day, wow, here it is. Fulfillment, completion, satisfaction, right? There it is. You don't have want to do anything anymore. You can just sit there because your life is now completely fulfilled. Of course, even with samadhi, it doesn't last. Even with samadhi, you lose the samadhi after a while. And then you have to use insight to overcome those hindrances completely and those problems completely. But it's a long step on the way when you get into a deep state of meditation. So there you are. And one of the problems here is that, I think I may have mentioned this before as well, is that sometimes the craving itself becomes like the purpose in life, the meaning in life, right? The very desire, because desire and craving, they have the sense that you are moving towards something worthwhile, like you have an aim, you have a purpose in life. That craving becomes important because you feel that you're actually doing something useful, moving towards something. to the point where you start to take the craving and the desire as yourself. This is your atta, right? The craving is what really is me. And of course, then you have a big problem, right? Because what that means, if you take the self, if the craving is the self, that, if that's who you are, then you start craving for craving, right? Because that is yourself, that's who you want to be. So you crave for the craving. And if you crave for the craving, if you crave for the desire, if you love the desire itself, then it's going to be impossible to overcome, or very hard to overcome. You have to. That's when you need the insight and understanding that the craving actually is a problem and is not something to be rejoiced in and to be happy about. But I think a lot of people in the world think that desire, craving itself, actually is a positive force that gives a sense of meaning to life. Not understanding that they are actually chained to that craving. They are chained to the world through that craving, and that there is no way out, in a sense. They are just going to keep on going and going and going here. So, okay, that is the simile of the dog. And so let's have a look at the second simile here. Householder, suppose a vulture, a heron, or a hawk seized a piece of meat and flew away, and then other vultures, herons, and hawks pursued it and pecked and clawed it. What do you think, householder, if that vulture, heron, or hawk does not quickly let go of that piece of meat? Wouldn't it incur death or deadly suffering because of that? Yes, venerable sir, so too, householder, a noble disciple considers thus. Sensual pleasures have been compared to a piece of meat by the Blessed One. They provide much suffering and much despair, while the danger in them is great. So here you have this bird seizing the piece of meat, right? This is a metaphor for the idea of grasping onto and attaching onto the pleasurable objects of the world. You grasp onto something, right? A new partner in life, a new boyfriend or girlfriend, a new some kind of new car, new house, new belongings, whatever it is, a new title perhaps even. All of these things, you grasp onto them. And as soon as you have grasped onto that partner, somebody else wants that partner, right? And then you have to fight it out with all these other vultures and herons and hawks to decide who is going to end up with that partner or whatever it is. And this is, life is often like that. Life is often, you know, there is a competitive thing. We have to compete over things. There's only so much to go around. And not just partners is a classic place where we fight over things, but also in many other areas of life. There's only so much to go around, and we fight over things. We fight over the inheritance from our parents. We fight over, when we're children, you fight over the toys or the last piece of cake, or you fight over the promotion, or you fight over, it's just endless, the things that you actually fight over. Nations fight with nations, right? You want the oil in the Middle East. You want the, I don't know what it is. And all of it ultimately derives, a lot of it anyway, ultimately derives from controlling resources, controlling the world, being in charge, and making sure that you can enjoy as much as possible. So, and this, I think, is one of those very important aspects, one of the really problematic areas of sensual objects and sensual pleasures, is that violence, all this, all anger, all of these things are just behind, right? You have the sensual pleasure at the forefront, and just behind it comes the anger, the violence, the fighting, all of that stuff. They are really a part and parcel of the same thing. They come together, and they're not something that really can be divided and separated apart, really. And that is kind of off-putting, right? You know that if there's going to be sensual desires, if there's going to be attachment to these things in your life, there's also going to be ill will, there's also going to be problems, there's going to be violence there to some degree, even if it's not very outwardly oriented, perhaps. All of these things will be there just behind the scenes. As soon as your desires are thwarted, you can't get it right, you can't get that partner, somebody else takes that partner, well, you're going to get so angry, you're going to get upset. And, you know, we know about the crimes of passion, some of the most the highest number of violence and murder are murders of passion, right? Because people are strongly attached to somebody else. So the connection, that a very important connection between the sensual desires of the world and the anger, the violence, and all the problems that we have in society, very, very close connection. It's kind of scary when you think about that. There's no such thing as just pure enjoyment without lots of other problems coming in its wake. Okay. So that is why then sensual pleasures have been compared to a piece of meat by the Blessed One. They provide much suffering and much despair, while the danger in them is great. Householder, next one. Householder, suppose a man took a blazing grass torch and went against the wind. What do you think, householder? If that man does not quickly let go of that blazing grass torch, wouldn't that blazing grass torch burn his hand or his arm or some other part of his body so that he might incur death or deadly suffering because of that? Yes, venerable sir, so too, householder, a noble disciple considers thus. Sensual pleasures have been compared to a grass torch by the Blessed One. They provide much suffering and much despair, while the danger in them is great. So sensual pleasures are like a grass torch. They give you a little bit of happiness, right? You can see, I can see, the grass torch kind of lights up the path or whatever. But if there is a wind and the wind goes against you, then you burn yourself very quickly. In the same way, as soon as you grasping hold of the grass torch, it's like grasping hold of the sensual objects of the world. You attach to them, you grasp them. You upadana, you remember from dependent origination, the word upadana, which means grasping, laying hold of, taking, attaching to. This is the problem with sensual pleasures. As soon as you attach to something, as soon as these things, they're all impermanent, right? They're all subject to disappearing and ceasing and fading away. And because you're attached to something which is impermanent, that's like asking for suffering. It's a, please come and make me suffer. That's what we're doing. Unwittingly, we don't really realize that. It's very hard to see. It thinks like, oh, this is going to be happy. This is going to be great. And of course, there is some degree of happiness there. If there wasn't any happiness, we wouldn't do it at all. There is some degree of happiness. But there's also a downside, right? And the downside is, as soon as you attach, then the impermanence will come and ensure that you suffer down the line somewhere. So there's always a problem there. And that is only part of the problem. The other part of the problem with that the simile points out as well is that take up these sensual pleasures, then very often you get intoxicated. You lose your sight of what you're supposed to be doing, and you end up doing bad actions as a consequence, right? Like I was saying before, crimes of passion or even just stealing and many of these things, they are based on sensual desire, and you do bad things as a consequence, and then of course you have to reap the consequences afterwards. So there's always pain with these things. They're never free of pain. There's no, there's certainly no free lunch with these ones, that's for sure. So the lunch is even less free than you thought it was. It's actually downright dangerous according to this. Okay. Next simile. Next one is a very powerful simile, a very strong one. Many of you have seen the simile before, but for those of you who haven't, it's very kind of strong. So let's see what it says. Householder, suppose there were a charcoal pit deeper than a man's height, full of glowing coals without flame or smoke. Then a man came who wanted to live and not to die, who wanted pleasure and recoiled from pain. And two strong men seized him by both arms and dragged him towards that charcoal pit. What do you think, householder? Would that man twist his body this way and that? Yes, venerable sir. Why is that? Because that man knows that if he falls into that charcoal pit, he would incur death or deadly suffering because of that. So too, householder, a noble disciple considers thus. Sensual pleasures have been compared to a charcoal pit by the Blessed One. They provide much suffering and much despair, while the danger in them is great. Right? That's one of those very powerful similes about sensual pleasures in the suttas. It's hard to really get your mind around. It's really hard to understand this. How can sensual pleasures be like a charcoal pit? Surely they are enjoyable, right? You enjoy these things. But no, says the Buddha, they're like a charcoal pit. It's almost as if you turn the world upside down. You say they are a terrible suffering, when in reality most people will say they are happiness, they are enjoyable. What is going on here? How is that possible? How can things be so different from what they appear to be? And the reason why, and of course, to some extent, this is where a degree of confidence and faith sometimes has to come into the comes into the Buddhist teachings as well. The reason is because we are so immersed in these things that we are blinded to what is going on. We've always been immersed in these things, and for that reason, we never really understand what is happening here. So the Buddha has this great simile of the mountain, and the simile of the mountain is where two friends, they kind of walk towards this mountain, and then one friend goes to the top of the mountain, the other one stays at the base, not really a mountain, like a hill or something, and then he goes to the top of the hill and he looks out and says, wow, I see all these fields, I see all these villages, I see all these forests, I see all these groves from the top of the mountain. And the one on the bottom says, don't be silly, you can't see anything of that from the top of the mountain. I don't believe a word of what you say here. Right? So he is very stubborn about it. So he's staying at the bottom, he's kind of immersed in sensual pleasures. Whereas the one who has gone to the top of the mountain, he has kind of emerged from sensuality and is seeing things from the vantage point of samadhi, right? He's looking down, wow, now I understand what's going on. So he goes down to his friend and he grabs him by the arm, right? Of course, you can't grab somebody by the arm to get them into samadhi, but that's just a simile. So grab him by the arm, pulls him up to the top of the mountain, and he says, look. And he says, what do you see? And he says, oh, I see villages, fields, I see groves, I see exactly what you said was to be there. And he says, well, why then do you stand at the bottom saying it doesn't exist? And he said, well, while I was down there, I was blinded. I was blinded by this mountain itself. And the mountain is almost like the mountain of defilements, a mountain of sensuality which stands in the way. So this is kind of the point here. As long as we haven't really risen above the sensual pleasures, as long as we are immersed in that world, we are like the fish in the water or the tadpole in the water who doesn't understand what is going on. And we have to get out of the water, first of all, to be able to get some kind of perspective of what water is. You don't know what wet is when you have always been wet, right? You don't understand what it means. In the same way, you don't really understand sensuality fully. You can understand it partially, but not fully, as long as you're fully immersed in it. So this is the problem. And the Buddha has another simile, which is found in another sutta in the Majjhima Nikaya called the Magandhya Sutta, which explains what is actually going on here. Excuse me. And what he says in the Magandhya Sutta, this is number 75 in the Majjhima Nikaya, if you want to look it up. And he says to this wanderer, this in India at that time they had all these wanderers, religious people, who were wandering around collecting alms and then living on that and doing some kind of spiritual practice, all kind of weird spiritual practices, some of them more mainstream, some of them very strange. And this Magandhya, who was supposed to be a wanderer, he was a wanderer who indulged in sensual pleasures. Sounds like a contradiction in terms, but he was kind of, yeah, sensual pleasures are great, this is what life is all about, etc. So, of course, the Buddha had to somehow try to explain to him that things may not be exactly what they seem like, right? And, of course, that is very difficult if somebody is very immersed in those things. So the Buddha uses this simile of the charcoal pit to explain this to Magandhya, what is going on. And he says to Magandhya, if you are a leper, you know, a leper, right? Leprosy, this kind of a disease which kind of you get sores on your limbs and your hands deteriorate really badly and your limbs kind of deteriorate very, very badly. After a while, your fingers kind of disappear, all this kind of stuff. He says to this Magandhya, well, a leper, because of all the worms and all the problems in his wounds, he will go to the charcoal pit or to a place where there is a fire, and he will burn, cauterize his hand in that fire, because all the itchiness, all the scabs, all the things that he have, they are so problematic, so painful, that when he burns them in a charcoal pit, he gets a sense of relief, right? For that leper, it's actually nice to burn himself. But then he says to Magandhya, so this is what the leper does. Why does the leper do that? Well, let's come back to that in a second. Then the leper goes to a doctor, and the doctor is able to cure him, right? He doesn't have any leprosy anymore. And he says to Magandhya, would that man now still go to that charcoal pit and burn his hands over those flames? And Magandhya says, no, of course not. Of course he wouldn't. And then Buddha says, well, why not? What's the difference? And the difference is that beforehand, his faculties were impaired. He was unable to see things according to reality. That charcoal pit was always hot. It was always burning, regardless. But his faculties, the way he was looking at the world, was so deranged that he wasn't able to feel those flames. He felt something else. He felt the happiness of getting rid of the itch. And of course, the itch is a little bit like craving, right? Craving is the itch which always propels you forward, always moves you to do other things. And very often, a very large part of the satisfaction of sensual pleasures is actually getting rid of the craving. The craving itself is painful because you're not satisfied, because you're not complete. You're seeking completion, you're seeking fulfillment. And then you run after the object of that craving, but actually, that fulfillment never really happens. All you get is more craving down the line. And the same thing with this leper, going back to that charcoal pit, going back to the flame, burning himself again and again and again, experiencing the pain, but not really experiencing it fully, because it also is a degree of pleasure there. And then one day, you get into samadhi, you stand on the mountaintop, you're outside the sensual pleasures, your limbs are healed, right? You don't want to touch those flames anymore. You don't want to touch those sensual pleasures, because you know they are painful. They burn you. They are craving inside. It's like a burning feeling whereby you feel that sense of dissatisfaction and agitation that you have as a consequence. So this is how you can start to kind of approach this kind of simile, because it's very hard to understand otherwise, right? How can you understand the idea that sensual pleasures are like a charcoal pit, a nice new car that's like a charcoal pit? Right, oh, look at that beautiful BMW. And no, keep it away from me. That's a charcoal pit. Don't get close to that nice BMW. Right? It's kind of difficult to really get one's hold. Or you get a kind of really nice new boyfriend or girlfriend, and you think, oh, no, don't get them too close to me. So it's hard to relate to. But so there's a degree of faith here and confidence that once you emerge from those sensual pleasures and you look back down on them, then you start to understand what is going on. Okay, so that is the simile of the charcoal pit. So if you feel that this is really strange, and many of you will not feel that at all, because I know you've been around for so long, you probably don't have much problems with this, but some of you who are new to this may feel this is really weird. Buddhism, what have I signed up for right here? So just remember that what this is about, it's about a way of looking at the world. So you just take it on board to the extent you can, right? And if it doesn't make any sense, forget about it. It's perfectly fine. It's supposed to be a way of reflecting on things, and not supposed to be a way to torture you. So don't torture yourself. Okay. Then we have a couple of more similes here about sensual pleasures, and these are much more understandable, certainly in my personal opinion. So let's have a look and see what they say here. Householder, suppose a man dreamt about lovely parks, lovely groves, lovely meadows, and lovely lakes, and on waking he saw nothing of it. So too, householder, a noble disciple considers thus, sensual pleasures have been compared to a dream by the Blessed One. They provide much suffering and much despair, while the danger in them is great. So sensual pleasures are like a dream. They are like this promise, this idea of the future, what the future is going to look like, right? You dream about that, whatever it is, you dream about things, that relationship, that that thing you're going to get for yourself, or whatever it is. And then when reality hits home, it is really nothing like it. Right? Reality is very different from what you thought it would be. It is never as satisfying, never as complete, never as fulfilling as you think it's going to be. And you still have that urge, that lack inside of you, that hole inside of you, that emptiness inside of you. Not the good emptiness of Buddhism, but the wrong kind of emptiness, right? We feel a sense of lack and despair. And that is still there, even after you get those things. So the craving breaks its promise. Its promise is happiness, fulfillment, and you don't actually get it at all. Right? So the dream is much more interesting. The dream is much more... the dream kind of looks very nice on paper, but the reality is actually very different. And this is just ordinary day-to-day cravings. It can be from any kind of craving. But also, if you look at the kind of the big picture, right, when you kind of start off, you're young and idealistic, you have ideas about what you're going to do with your life, right? You're going to have a career like this, live in a house like that, have a partner like this. You have this kind of all, and often with a lot of hubris, right? When you're young, you think you're going to conquer the world. This is what young people think. But the reality is always completely different. And then you kind of have to downgrade your dreams a little bit, right? And you downgrade them, go down and down and down until you end up as a monk. That's when you kind of the lowest... the lowest of the low. You have a tiny little hut in the forest. You wear these kind of brown robes, right? And so you downgrade. So this is the kind of the reality. Reality is that the dreams and the reality are so different. And notice that in your life. And when you start noticing that, again, it starts to turn you away a little bit from these things. The craving lies to you. The craving is like the dream, right? It is a liar. It promises something. It never actually delivers what it promises. Okay. Next one. Householder, suppose a man borrowed goods on loan, a fancy carriage and fine jeweled earrings, and proceeded and surrounded by those borrowed goods, he went to the marketplace. Then people seeing him would say, "Sirs, that is a rich man. That is how the rich enjoy their wealth." Then the owners, whenever they saw him, would take back their things. What do you think, householder? Would that be enough for that man to become dejected? Yes, venerable sir. Why is that? Because the owners took back their things. So too, householder, a noble disciple considers thus, sensual pleasures have been compared to borrowed goods by the Blessed One. They provide much suffering and much despair, while the danger is in them is great. So whenever you get something, whenever you get into a new relationship, whenever you do whatever, remember all of that stuff, all of the things you own, all of the relationships you have, whatever it is, all the friendships you have, etc., etc., all of that is borrowed goods, right? These are things you're going to have to pay back. You're going to have to give it up. None of these things are going to last, right? It's like this man, and you can see here what's going on here. This man, he has this fancy carriage, right? Fine jeweled earrings. I guess these were luxury goods at the time. He couldn't really afford it, right? So he borrows it. And then, of course, when you borrow these things and you kind of, people say, "Oh, look at this man. Wow, he's really wealthy." And you kind of feel maybe a bit of pride, right? All these people think they think that you're better than you actually are. Yeah. And, of course, because of that, you attach to these things, right? You attach to these borrowed goods. And because you're attached to them, when the owners come and take them back, you feel kind of lost. You feel naked. You feel, "Oh, what happened to all the things that were mine?" And you suffer as a consequence. And this is the problem with life. We do these things all the time. We have all these things. We build up a whole life very often, built up out of just keeping, amassing things and whatever it is. Not just material good, but also mental and psychological goods like titles and all kind of things, social connections or whatever it is. And then one day it has to be given back. At the very latest, it has to be given back when you die, right? That's the very latest, but often before that. When you die, suddenly you are naked again. You have nothing. Everything has to go. Absolutely everything. And you're standing there feeling kind of betrayed, right? You spent your whole life amassing these things, and now you have to let them go. And you start to wonder, why did I spend my whole blooming life, amassing all this stuff, but now I have to give it up. What a waste of time. What was this all about? What was the point of all that? And you kind of lying in there on the deathbed wondering, you know, why? What's going on? Kind of confused and bewildered about life's weird kind of turns, right? But if you think about it before, it's very obvious this is going to happen. It's kind of absolutely obvious. It must happen in that way. And the only difference, perhaps, is that for most people, if you only believe in one life, a materialist kind of idea of the world, and if when you die that's it, okay, well then maybe you can justify that kind of life. But especially if you believe in an idea that there is a success, life continues after you die, the mind goes on, then of course this becomes really crazy. Because you realize that instead of investing in this enormous, broad expanse of lives, one after the other, instead of investing in this in your real future, you have invested into this tiny little life right here, this tiny little slice, and you have neglected the rest of your future completely. You haven't done anything for all of that. So what this does, if you think about this, it kind of reminds you, I have to change my investment strategy, right? Invest in a different way. Get some long-term return, not just a short-term return. And of course, the idea is that if you do invest for the long term, it also has a good short-term return as well. The two things go together. So what is that long-term return? What is the long-term? Of course, the long-term return is to practice kindness in your life, practice goodness, practice generosity, do some meditation, have compassion for others, try to be wise about things, right? Live a life of wisdom, etc., etc. That is where we are building up your own mind, building up your internal qualities, because those qualities are the only thing that you will take with you when you pass away. That's the only thing you will take with you, because they are kind of, this is your level of your consciousness, right? You're building up your level of consciousness. And as we were talking about before with dependent origination, once you have built that level of consciousness up to a certain place, that's where you start off in your future life, and you carry on from there. So you change your ideas. You look at things in a different way. You start to prioritize differently. It doesn't mean that you shouldn't have any success in this life. You can still have success in this life. But what it means, that success is secondary here. Your primary concern is living a good life, living well. And if success comes, great. If it doesn't come, it doesn't matter so much, because you have a good life anyway. So it's secondary here. It doesn't mean that you have to shun success in the worldly sense. It just means that it's a secondary thing in this whole game. And then you get your priorities right, and then life proceeds much better. I like when Adam Brahm saying this, that happiness does not come from success. Success comes from happiness, right? So if you live your life well, in the right way, in a spiritual way, doing what is right, then that tends to bring success along at the same time. So this is just a different way of looking at things, right? Understanding that everything we have in this world are borrowed goods. How much do you want to invest in those things? Things that you have to give up at any time. And how much instead will you invest in those things that actually have a real long-term return? There is actually another simile in the suttas as well, which focuses on the same thing. There's actually quite a bit in the suttas about sensual pleasures. And if you look at the five hindrances in the suttas, there's some nice similes that go together with the five hindrances. And it says there that kamachanda, which is a hindrance of sensual desire, that kamachanda is like, similarly, is like borrowing things. So whenever you have some sensual desire, or you attach to the sensual things in the world, it's like you have a debt, you fall into a debt as a consequence. And that debt will have to be repaid the moment you get that item or whatever it is gets kind of taken away from you. And usually you have to pay some interest, right? You have to pay some interest in extra suffering and all these kind of things at the same time. And you have to look after these things, right? One of the problems when you have many things, you have to look after them. And you have to make sure that they're okay, and you kind of worry about them and all these kind of things. And this is part of the interest payment that you pay as far as all these worldly things are concerned. Okay. So let's have a look at the last of these similes. Okay. So, householder, suppose there were a dense grove not far from some village or town, within which there was a tree laden with fruit, but none of its fruit had fallen to the ground. Then a man came, needing fruit, seeking fruit, wandering in search of fruit, and he entered the grove and saw the tree laden with fruit. Thereupon he thought, "This tree is laden with fruit, but none of its fruit has fallen to the ground. I know how to climb a tree, so let me climb this tree, eat as much fruit as I want, and fill my bag." And he did so. Then a second man came, needing fruit, seeking fruit, wandering in search of fruit, and taking a sharp axe, he too entered the grove and saw that tree laden with fruit. Thereupon he thought, "This tree is laden with fruit, but none of its fruit has fallen to the ground. I do not know how to climb a tree, so let me cut this tree down at its root, eat as much fruit as I want, and fill my bag." And he did so. What do you think, householder? If that first man who had climbed the tree doesn't come down quickly when the tree falls, wouldn't he break his hand or his foot or some other part of his body, so that he might incur death or deadly suffering because of that? Yes, venerable sir. So too, householder, a noble disciple considers thus. Sensual pleasures have been compared to fruits on a tree by the Blessed One. They provide much suffering and much despair, while the danger in them is great. So here you have this man who enters the dense grove, right? He comes from some village or town. The village or town is perhaps some other kind of life in the past, and he gets reborn into this life. And this life is like this dense grove, right? You're wandering around in this dense grove, which is called the sensual realm of human existence. And as you're walking around in this dense grove, you're looking around, looking out for sensual pleasures, right? Looking up at the trees, is there some sensual pleasures I can enjoy here? You know, it's a bit like walking. I can think of the classic example would be Orchard Road in Singapore. I don't know if you've been to Orchard Road in Singapore. It's like this shopping paradise, right, with people wandering around kind of aimlessly from shop to shop, shopping here, shopping there. Very expensive, but everything looks very beautiful, right? Looking out for something I can buy here. This is what samsara is like, looking out for things to enjoy in the same way. I apologize to the Singaporeans here for talking about Orchard Road in that way. But and then, of course, as you're wandering around in samsara, occasionally you find something nice. Whoa, this is something I want. This is something beautiful. This is something I can enjoy here. And then when you find that, you climb that tree where those sensual desires are available. And you get up into the tree and you start eating, right? And of course, as you are enjoying those sensual pleasures, you lose your mindfulness. You lose your sense of what is going on. You lose your perspective. You get intoxicated by those sensual pleasures. This is one of those intoxications in life. And we were talking about before about old age, death, and sickness, right? And the opposites being the intoxications. Sensual pleasure is also one of the intoxications, according to the suttas. So you sit up there, you lose all sense of what is happening around you. You have no idea what's going on anymore. And then this other fellow comes along with an axe and starts chopping down that tree, right? And if you don't kind of gain your senses, gain your mindfulness quickly, so you find out what's going on, you're going to have a problem as a consequence. And you're going to fall down and you might die or whatever as a result of that. And of course, the point of all this is that when you become intoxicated, when you lose your sense of what is right and wrong, what is up and down, what is black and white, and you really kind of, you know, everything gets very mixed up inside of you, then you start doing bad things as a consequence. You forget that doing good is what matters in the long run. This is what intoxication leads to. And that is the problem with those intoxications. So again, you have there's a problem there, and you are led astray. And that is how I would regard that simile. But I think there may be other ways of looking at that simile. It's quite a rich one. There may be more to it than what I have just mentioned just right there. Anyway, so that's all about sensual pleasures, right? So Now you go back home, you may not be able to eat your dinner again in the same way. It may feel different. No, please enjoy your dinner. It's not so much about not enjoying these things. It's more about having a perspective on them and understanding what they are about. That's really what it is about here. So please keep that in mind. I should maybe mention here as well, we did talk about the simile in the suttas about climbing the mountain and seeing things from above and then understanding what it's all about. And that is very similar to the story, if you have read Ajahn Brahm's book, The Opening Door of Your Heart book, and you read that one, he has a similar kind of story in there, which is very fascinating because it kind of shows you how these things often tie together here. And that is the story. And when he was in Central America, he was in Guatemala, and he was traveling around, and he was going to see all the ancient Mayan pyramids in Guatemala. And he's on the Yucatan Peninsula, one of the peninsulas down there, and he's traveling around. This was in the 1960s, I think. This was, you know, long before the tourism had really started down there and all of this. So he's traveling around in the jungle, and it's a very, very dense jungle, and he has to travel on the rivers, and then he has to get on board a truck and travel these gravel roads, and all the time he's way below the canopy of the jungle, and all he sees is trees and greenery everywhere. He can maybe see a few meters, 10, 20 meters ahead of him. That's about it. Everything is kind of very dense, right? You're in the jungle of sensual pleasures. And then one day, according to the story as he tells it, he comes to the pyramid. In those days, there was no tourist, right? So the pyramid is just sitting there. There's no fees, there's nobody guarding it, anything like that. So he just climbs the pyramid, just like perhaps the ancient Mayan priests would have done at that time. So he climbs the pyramid, and for the first time, you know, in days, traveling in days through the jungle, he gets above the canopy here, and he can see out, and he can see to the horizon, and he can see the jungle below, he can see the little rivers, he can see the little roads where everything is going, and he can see all the way to the horizon where the canopy and where the jungle actually ends, and probably find the ocean beyond that. And this is he realized that this is what life is like, right? One day you have a deep experience in meditation, and you kind of raise yourself above the ordinary understanding of the world. You see the world in a new way. You get perspective of what is going on, and for the first time you understand what sensual pleasures are, what the danger are, and also what the gratification are in those things. You understand them fully for the first time. And then, of course, you can start to make wise decisions, right? Informed decisions. If you don't know what's going on, you can't really make informed decisions. But once you do, you can start to use that information to make good decisions in life. What really matters, what really is important, what you should be doing with your life, etc. Okay, so let's have a quick look at the next sutta as well. The Samvidhi Sutta. This is also one of my favorite. I have so many favorite suttas, so probably you can say the Four Nikayas is probably my favorite suttas. So there's quite a few here. So please don't ask me to read all my favorite suttas because it will take a long, long time. So this is the Samvidhi Sutta, and this is from the Devata Samyutta, and this is all little stories about the Buddha and other people talking to devatas. Devatas are these kind of divine beings, right, that sometimes have interaction with human beings. I still think, probably still today, people have interaction with these devatas, but probably we don't really recognize them as divine beings, so that's why we don't understand what is going on. But let's not get sidetracked with that sort of stuff, even though it is interesting. So let's have a quick look at this one. Thus have I heard, on one occasion the Blessed One was dwelling at Rajagaha in the Hot Springs Park. Then the Venerable Samvidhi, having risen at the first flush of dawn, went to the hot springs to bathe. Having bathed in the hot springs and come back out, he stood in one robe, drying his limbs. Then, when the night had advanced, a certain devata of stunning beauty, illuminating the entire hot springs, approached the Venerable Samvidhi. Having approached, she stood in the air and addressed the Venerable Samvidhi in verse. Without having enjoyed, you seek alms, bhikkhu. You don't seek alms after you have enjoyed. First enjoy, bhikkhu, then seek alms. Don't let the time pass you by. I do not know what the time might be. The time is hidden and cannot be seen. Hence, without enjoying, I seek alms. Don't let the time pass me by. So a little bit of a slightly cryptic verse, right? You're not really sure exactly what this is supposed to mean. But of course, the divine being is saying, you know, what's the point in living that kind of life? You don't have a, you know, you can enjoy yourself with all kind of things. So do that first instead of living like a bhikkhu. What a waste of a good opportunity is to be a bhikkhu when you could be enjoying yourself instead. That's kind of the message from this devata. And the bhikkhu doesn't agree. So, yes. And then that devata alighted on the earth and said to the Venerable Samidhi, you have gone forth while young, bhikkhu, a lad with black hair, endowed with the blessing of youth, in the prime of life without having dallied with sensual pleasures. Enjoy human sensual pleasures, bhikkhu. Do not abandon what is directly visible in order to pursue what takes time. I have not abandoned what is directly visible, friend, in order to pursue what takes time. I have abandoned what takes time in order to pursue what is directly visible. For the Blessed One, friend, has stated that sensual pleasures are time-consuming, full of suffering, full of despair, and the danger in them is still greater. While this Dhamma is directly visible, immediate, inviting one to come and see, applicable, to be personally experienced by the wise. Right? So the Deva is saying, well, you know, the spiritual path, you know, you have to practice, you have to keep all these rules, and who knows where it's going to get you. It all takes so much time. But here you are, all around you, you know, you are young, you could have a wife, and you can make money and enjoy yourself. Why? This is the way to find happiness. Right? And the bhikkhu has a different idea. So who is right here? And most people will probably say the devata is right, right? Why on earth be a monastic? It doesn't make any sense at all. You are foregoing all the happinesses of the world, and you have this opportunity. This is what most people would say. And I remember when I was overseas somewhere, I was with a large group of Buddhists. There was many hundreds there. And I was talking about the sutta, and I asked the congregation, well, what do you think? Who is right, the devata or the monk? And there was one young man on the front row saying, yeah, the devata is right, the devata is right. And it was funny, everybody burst out laughing, of course, because he was just saying what he felt was right? And that's how it seems to us. So how is it that this monk could actually be right? What is how is that possible? And the way to understand this is that, of course, this is what we've been talking about all along. With craving, you are never really there. You're always living in the future. You never really get to that point of satisfaction. The craving tells you, you will be satisfied if you just fulfill me. But craving is always about the future. It is always about getting somewhere else. It's about following a moving target. Target always changing, and you're always trying to catch up with something, and you never actually get there, and craving always re-arises. So it's time-consuming. In fact, it's not just time-consuming, it's endless. There is no final satisfaction with that. It just keeps on going forever and ever and ever. Whereas the Dhamma, of course, does have an end. There is a goal, there is a point of final satisfaction, or final relief from suffering, final relief from craving and all kinds of problems. There is an end. And in that sense, it is timeless, beyond time, and it brings you in the right direction. But not only does it have an end, but there's something more about the Dhamma as well. And that is, if you practice the Dhamma in this moment, if in this moment you do an act of kindness, you feel good straight away as a consequence of that, right? If in this moment you think a kind thought about somebody, straight away it has an effect on you. You don't have to wait. There's no craving involved. There's no problem involved. You feel good now. And this is kind of what the whole of these spiritual practices are about. And that is why the happiness you get from the spiritual practice is very different from the happiness of the sensuality. Happiness of sensuality is about the future. The happiness of spirituality is in the present moment. If you do something good and you feel happy about it, it's right here, right now. When you sit down to meditate and you recall the good things you have done in the past, you feel happy in the present moment. You don't have to wait for anything. It's right here, right now. It's a very different kind of satisfaction. It makes you feel fulfilled. It makes you feel complete. It makes you feel that you actually have achieved something, that you have reached a real goal, and your aim is actually gradually being fulfilled as a consequence. So it's a different type of happiness, and one that is not doesn't have anything to do with time. And I think it's a very important point, a very interesting point, because it seems so counterintuitive, perhaps, at first. And so you have to think about it a little bit to understand what this is meant to, what is meant here. I remember reading the sutta, and first few times I read it, I was kind of scratching my head, what is going on here? What is actually happening here? And then slowly it dawned on me what was going on here. So, that is the Samiddhi Sutta, and there are many other nice suttas also about sensual pleasure, but these are some of my favorites, and I always like to indulge myself, so I apologize if you didn't enjoy it, at least I enjoyed it. That is very selfish of me, right? But sometimes you don't know what people enjoy, so you just have to, it's much more important that you enjoy it yourself, because then hopefully everybody else also gets something out of it. Anyway, we have just come to the end of this session already, so I'll see you again at 7:30 this evening here.